law, he will explain the lawsuit, House versus Price, in which the House of Representatives is suing the Department of Health and Human Services over the way the department is paying insurers for the cost-sharing reductions. John Bertko is an independent actuarial consultant for Covered California, California's marketplace. He will provide an on-the-ground perspective of the cost-sharing reductions and how their loss would affect consumers and markets. Deep Banerjee is director and sector lead S&P Global. He will discuss findings from a recent S&P report on the ACA marketplaces and the market effects of the uncertainty surrounding the cost-sharing reductions. I am going to provide some brief background on the cost-sharing reductions before turning to Timothy Jost. I have provided a chart pack for your reference in the materials, but I will not go through the exhibits. Insurers that sell plans in the individual and small group markets must offer plans at four different levels of cost exposure, also known as actuarial value. Bronze plans must cover 60% of medical costs on average, silver plans 70%, gold plans 80%, and platinum plans 90%. To ensure that low and moderate income enrollees can afford their health care, the law requires that insurers participating in the marketplaces offer silver-level plans with reduced cost sharing for people with incomes under 250% of poverty, which is about $30,000 for an individual. The lower someone's income is, the greater the share of costs covered by a silver plan. For example, for people earning less than 150% of poverty, which is about $18,000 for an individual, silver plans effectively become platinum plans, covering 94% of costs on average. For people with incomes up to 200% of poverty, about $24,000 for an individual, the plans cover about 87% of costs on average. And for people earning up to 250% of poverty, the plans are closer to silver, covering 73% of costs. But insurers price these plans as if they were the standard silver plans, even though they are much higher value. To cover insurers' costs, the federal government reimburses insurers directly for these cost reductions. In 2017, nearly 6 of 10 marketplace enrollees selected these cost-reduced plans, or about 7 million people. These enrollees have lower deductibles, copays, and out-of-pocket spending limits. In a Commonwealth Fund analysis of silver-level marketplace plans in the largest cities in 38 states in 2016, the cost-sharing reductions lowered deductibles for someone with an income of $17,000 by an average of $3,400 and out-of-pocket limits by nearly $6,000 compared to a silver plan with no cost-sharing reductions. If this person had health problems that made him a high user of health care, the cost-sharing reductions would reduce his out-of-pocket spending during the year from $6,000 to $650, or from more than one-third of his annual income to just 3.8% of his income. Despite how effective these subsidies have been in lowering health care costs for millions of Americans, their future is currently uncertain, with wide-ranging implications for consumers, insurers, and the marketplaces. I will now turn to Timothy Jost. In the chart pack you have, you can go to Exhibit 11.
House v. Price, formerly known as House v. Burwell, began as an attempt by the House of Representatives to hold President Obama responsible for what it viewed as abuses of presidential power. On July 30, 2014, the House voted along party lines to file an unprecedented lawsuit challenging the president's implementation of the ACA. The complaint, filed on November 21, 2014, challenged the administration's 2013 decision to delay the implementation of the employer mandate, as well as the administration's funding of the cost-sharing reduction payments we've just heard about, which the House argued lacked an explicit appropriation. The administration moved to dismiss the House's complaint, arguing that the federal courts had no jurisdiction to hear the complaints because members of Congress can't sue the executive. It argued that Congress had not suffered any injury from the administration's actions and that allowing the House to sue would violate constitutional separation of powers principles. In September 2015, Judge Rosemary Collier rejected the House's employer mandate delay claim as a routine dispute over interpretation of the law. She refused to dismiss, however, the House's claim that the funding of the cost-sharing reductions without an explicit appropriation infringed on the constitutional authority of Congress to appropriate funds, and the case proceeded. In May of 2016, she ruled for the House on the merits. She noted that the ACA had amended the Internal Revenue Code's refund appropriation to pay for the premium tax credits, but had not made a parallel change for cost-sharing reduction payments. She rejected the government's argument that Congress intended to cover the cost-sharing reduction payments through the premium tax credit appropriation, and the government had argued that the two programs appear in the same phrase at 44 places in the Affordable Care Act. She also rejected arguments that there was an appropriation based on the ACA's legislative history, actions by Congress after its enactment, the mandatory nature of the statute, which says that HHS must make payments, and the chaos that would ensue if payments were stopped. She enjoined the payment of the cost-sharing reductions until Congress appropriates the money, but stayed her injunction pending appeal. The government did appeal to the D.C. Circuit, arguing that the lower court's decision should be overturned because the decision itself was unconstitutional, as the court lacked jurisdiction. It also argued that the decision was wrong on the merits because, the government argued, there is an appropriation. The House's brief was due in November, but the House asked a couple of times that the case be continued, most recently because it was engaged in settlement negotiations with the Trump administration. On March 2, 2017, the court entered an order further staying the case and directing the parties to file a status court report by May 22nd and on 90 days intervals thereafter. It's important to note that nothing necessarily happens on May 22nd. The case is effectively stayed indefinitely. Payments were presumably made to the insurers on April 20th, and the next payments will be due on May 19th. The Trump administration could stop making payments at any time. The ACA, again, however, says that the government shall pay the cost-sharing reduction payments, and the obligation to pay is embodied in regulation. If the Trump administration stopped paying, the insurers would likely sue in the Court of Claims. Recipients could also try to intervene in the appeal to keep it alive, perhaps joined by insurers. The administration is unlikely to simply dismiss its appeal, as that would leave in place a precedent that a single House of Congress can sue the administration over any appropriations issue, a precedent that no president would want to have in place. The administration and Congress could jointly request the Court of Appeals to remand the case to the district court to dismiss it, but the House may be unwilling to do this because it may want to preserve the precedent that it can sue the president. If the Congress appropriates the funding for the CSRs, as I hope it will this week, the administration could argue that the case is moot, but the lower court's order is not limited in duration. So unless Congress adopts a permanent mandatory appropriation, the case is not necessarily moot. Certainly, however, if the House appropriates the money, particularly if it does so for both 2017 and 2018, and it is a mandatory appropriation, the legal disposition of the case becomes much less important, and the consequences that John and Deep will describe will be forestalled. Now to John.
Hi, this is Sarah Collins. I'm just introduced John Burko. He is an independent actuarial consultant for Covered California, California's marketplace. He'll provide an on-the-ground perspective of the cost-sharing reductions and how their loss would affect consumers and markets.
Thanks, Sarah. What I'm going to do is highlight a few results, key results of a study that we did at Covered California with Professor Wes Yin, who's a behavioral economist at UCLA. So if you turn to slides 15 first, what's the impact? We used actual 2015 data for the cost-sharing subsidy funding and for the baseline premiums there. What we found is if you take the interpretation that the amount of funding would be loaded on only silver plans, then the increase needed would be 16.6%. And I say this particular way instead of loading all tiers because I used to work for occasionally departments of insurance, and the key phrase is any rate increases have to be necessary and sufficient. So raising rates on the other tiers would not be necessary. Going to the next slide, you can see from the two bars there, the before and after, net of subsidy. And so if you look at the two silver bars, they're the same because the subsidies for subsidized people would hold them the same, whereas the red bars, which are after subsidy, would actually decrease because the premium subsidy is tied, of course, to the second lowest silver plan, and that then affects every other tier of benefits. Okay, going to slide 17, what we saw here is that in addition to just changing the ways that the subsidies are administered, the economic impact would probably lead for some migration out of silver, and you can see on slide 17 the number of people in the or percentage in the silver plan decreases a bit. Bronze goes up because since the APTC subsidy increases, we have more bronze plans which become free, so people will move to those. And in some cases, in some regions, gold plans become cheaper than the resulting silver plan. So there could be some unsubsidized folks that move off of Covered California from silver to gold. In slide 18, though, the key issue, one of the key issues here to point out is that removing subsidies that are due for funding the cost-sharing reductions, which in our case happened to be about $750 million in 2015, would actually have an increase on the amount that is picked up by the APTC premium subsidy. And this is because that the APTC applies not only to just silver, but is carried through for bronze in particular, for gold, and for platinum. So it would jump up from $750 million of reduction to $976 million of greater APTC payments. And this is already accounting for an additional $195 million that would be foregone by bronze enrollees because the bronze subsidy can never go under zero. So some people could actually have a subsidy which was greater than their premium in bronze. I'm going to jump ahead here to slide 20 now, because this also, due to the single risk pool, has an impact on plan choice off exchange. So if a plan is offering silver on exchange, it's got to do the same thing off exchange. And you can see here that the silver enrollment will most likely go down because the silver premiums will jump by 16.5%. Probably this is going to mean, according to our economist micro-simulation model, that bronze increases a certain amount. And, again, there's probably some increase in the enrollment in gold. Just to show an illustration of what this means, if you go to slide 21, what we've got there is two people. We've put them in at 150% of federal poverty level, which is roughly $20,000, and in our West L.A. region. So the total premium jumps from 270 to 315 for the 40-year-old, but you can see the blue part at the bottom there for their premium net of the subsidy remains the same. For a 60-year-old, the jump is more pronounced. It jumps from 574 to almost $670, so nearly $100 of increase. But once again, the net premium after subsidy is constrained by how much money the person earns. So that all stays the same. With that, I only have one more extra tidbit of news that comes from some work we just completed last week. If you go to slide 23, and there's some descriptions of it on 22, California is lucky. We have a statewide database that captures the hospital discharges and emergency room visits for 100% of people in California, for people from employers, from Medi-Cal, from Covered California, and the uninsured. And we use this to give our plans an advanced peek at what their likely 2017 enrollment base is going to be. And if you look at the three slides, they go from 1.07 in 2015 to a raw score of 1.11 in 2016, and then come down a couple of percent, 1.09, for those 2017 enrollees. And so what we're seeing here is for our enrollees coming through, we're actually slightly healthier for chronic conditions in 2017. So our market and outreach is continuing to do pretty well. And with that, I'll turn it back over to Sarah.
Thank you, John. And we'll now turn to Deep Banerjee. Deep is Director and Sector Lead, S&P Global.
Thank you, Sarah. So I'm going to briefly talk about a recent study we published that looked at the operating performance of insurers in the individual market, and then end with our forecast for this marketplace. So the best place to start would be on slide 26. As most of you know by now, 2014, which we really believe is year one of the individual marketplace as we know it today, wasn't very good in terms of operating performance for insurance companies. As a matter of fact, 2015 ended up being worse than 2014, which really put a spotlight on how 2016 would fare. Because if 2016 ended up being even worse, we would really be struggling with this marketplace and questioning whether this is at all a manageable market. However, if you go to the next slide, you'll see medical loss ratios indicate that 2016 was actually better than 2015. This slide takes into account all the Blue Cross Blue Shield plans, excluding the blue in California, and we found that the average medical loss ratio, and a quick way to think about medical loss ratio is for every dollar in premium the insurance company receives, how much are they paying out in claims? So if you look at 2014 and 2015, the medical loss ratio for the individual market was actually above 100%. Which means insurance companies had to pay out more than they received in premiums. But then if you move to 2016, the medical loss ratio, the average number is about 92%. Now, 92% is better than the years previous, but it is important to note it is still not very good. After including in admin costs, most insurance companies would have lost money in 2016 as well. But more importantly, what is our forecast? If we think of business as usual, and what we mean by that is ACA in the current form continues, with some fixes, obviously, but not a complete overall, we believe 2017 will continue the positive trajectory that we have seen in 2016. Insurers on average will likely report close to break-even margins. This is going to be driven by the sharp price correction we have seen, as well as product and network design changes. Looking forward to 2018, we expect this path to continue, and more insurers will report very low but still positive margins. It is important to note we believe this is a fragile market and does need time to stabilize. The next slide talks about, I guess if the last slide was business as usual, this is business interrupted or business unusual. Well, obviously the big uncertainty in the horizon is the CSR. Without clarity over the cost-sharing subsidy, we believe insurance companies are left with two options. One is pricing in what we are saying an uncertainty buffer, or loading up the silver plan with the amount that they will lose from not having a cost-sharing reduction paid to them. The important point to note is the cost-sharing reduction is actually paid after the fact to insurance companies. So most insurance companies don't want to be in a situation where they find half the way into 2018 that they're not going to be paid for the money that they have already paid out for the cost share for the CSR eligible plans. Now, this means there's a potential for insurance companies to also be more selective on where they participate. So participation issues which do exist in the marketplace may only intensify in the last year. But if the role of Congress is rulemaking, the role of HHS is enforcing those rules. ACA in its current form, till it's changed, needs to be enforced by HHS because that's what the insurers are pricing to. So things like special enrollment period, individual mandate, and enrollment outreach will be top of the agenda for next year. That's all I have.
Thank you, Deep. And we'll open the floor to questions now.
At this time, if you would like to register to ask a question, please press the star and one on your touch-tone telephone. If you find your question has been answered, you may withdraw your question at any time by pressing the pound key. Once again, to ask a question, please press the star and one on your touch-tone phone. We will pause momentarily to allow questions to queue. And once again, to ask a question, that is star and one on your touch-tone phone. Thank you so much for your patience. We will be taking our first question momentarily. And our first question will come from Robert Pear with the New York Times. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Thank you. This is perhaps for Mr. Bertko. I can see how eliminating cost-sharing reductions leads to higher premiums. How do you determine how much of an increase there is?
Thanks for the question. We did this using our 2015 data. Because we are the state exchange, we could see that $750 million was paid out in CSR funding during 2015. We looked at the total silver plan premium, which I think was a little over $4 million, and so came up with that, $4 billion, came up with that 16.6%. So, again, it's a projection using actual 2015 data. Things will change from year to year, and I suspect we might actually have a few more people enrolled in CSR plans as we become more successful in publishing them.
So what you do is you look at how much income or revenue they lose because of the cost-sharing reductions, and then you see how much the premiums have to increase to make up that same amount, roughly.
Exactly. It's a fairly simple calculation.
Thank you.
And once again, that is star and one to ask a question. Star and one to ask a question. Okay, and we will take our next question from Donna Rosato with Consumer Report. Please.
Hi. Yes. Thanks for. Hi. Yes. Thanks for taking the questions. Two questions. How much is there an estimate for how much the CSRs would be in 2018? And the second is, how will the impact vary around the U.S. if the CSRs are not funded? In other words, would some markets be able to weather it better than others?
This is John. I will only attest to what Kaiser Family Foundation published, I think, about a week ago or so. That is, the impact will vary from state to state. The expansion states were in the lower end of a range, about 15 to 17 or 18%. The highest was, I think, in the low 20s with a 19% average. And my comment would be, like in our state where this is $750 million, you cannot ignore it. So it's not something that could be just weathered. In total for 2018, I can only recall, this is off the top of my head, that CSRs across the nation might be about $7 billion in spending, and that's about the right. California is about 10% of the total, so that sounds about right.
Yeah, Deep here, just to add to that, we don't expect any state, no state will be able to weather without a without substituting for the CSR not being there. So we don't expect anyone to say, oh, I don't need to raise my premiums because I can eat up the CSR on my own. That's not possible. And to John's point, that there is disparity today between states in terms of average premiums because cost does differ greatly between states, which means that something like this adds to the difference between state premiums and state underlying costs.
And this is Tim. I would just add that I would not be at all surprised if there would be some states where no insurers would come back at all rather than try to stay in the market and raise premiums.
This is Sarah. We also have on the Commonwealth Fund website an analysis of how these would affect different carriers. So the risk, so not each carrier is equally affected. It's a blog post by Mark Hall and Mike McHugh on our site, and you can see that variability across carriers.
Great, thank you.
And we will take our next question from Karen Pallarito with Health Day. Please go ahead.
Great. Thank you so much. Really appreciate the briefing. So I think Obamacare customers and would-be customers really want to know what's going to happen in 2018. So I wondered, just to throw it out to the panel, if you could expand a little bit about what you expect 2018 plan participation to be, given the uncertainty about the cost-sharing reduction, and what the breadth of choice might be across the marketplace.
Yeah, this is Deep here. Thanks for the question. Yeah, so we think for most insurers, they're really left with two choices. If they want to stay in the marketplace and want to continue this trajectory of actually improving their bottom line, not the other way around, they will have to increase premiums to offset the CSRs not being there. And like I said before, the biggest thing about the CSR is the fact that it's paid after the fact. So they don't want to be in a situation where they find out later in 2018 that they don't get the premiums, the CSR dollars that they were supposed to get, because it's too late by then. So they would take corrective action in advance of that. The second choice, obviously, would be to be more selective in where they participate. And that would mean there is a possibility that there will be certain counties in 2018 where there may be a less number of insurers than there are today.
Okay, we will take our next question from Dan Mangan with CNBC. Please go ahead.
Hi, this question is specifically to Tim, but anybody else can join in. Tim, what do you expect to actually happen here with the court case? What's your best guess? And also, how do you think the fate of the American Health Care Act will play into that?
Well, I don't expect the court case to go anywhere until the administration and the Congress decide what they're going to do next with the cost-sharing reduction payments, which, again, I am really hoping is going to get wrapped up this week in the continuing resolution, at least in the short term. And with respect to the American Health Care Act, it would repeal the CSRs as of, I believe, the end of 2019, so it would cease to be an issue after that. But you would still need an appropriation to carry us through from now until then, unless both the House and the Trump administration decide to just let the case sit there and keep on paying the cost-sharing reduction payments. But I think that everyone is saying, the insurers, consumer organizations, the Chamber of Commerce, the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, let's get this drama over with. Let's appropriate the money for the CSRs. This case has never been about whether an appropriation was appropriate or not. The only question was whether the expenditure was appropriate or not, if there wasn't an explicit appropriation. So it seems to me the solution here is pretty obvious to everybody, and the consequences of not solving the problem are pretty dire.
One follow-up I have for you, Tim, is you noted the American Health Care Act would end the CSRs after 2019. But do you think that this is yet another poison pill for people that want to repeal it, that when Congress, members of Congress, senators are faced with the prospect of killing CSRs, they're going to say, wait, that's not going to help us at all because people won't be able to afford to use their plans? That's the main critique, or a main critique now of the ACA.
Well, if the question is this another argument for total repeal because we can just let the CSR stop and the market will collapse, I think that is the position a few people are taking. But, millions of people have their health insurance and their health coverage and their health care and their lives at stake, and I'm just doesn't seem to me to be a responsible position.
Mm-hmm.
Was that responsive, Dan?
Yeah, and I was actually asking the reverse, but he answered that. My point is that if you realize how much you're going to lose, how much people are going to lose if the CSRs go away, that even people that are opposed to Obamacare will have a problem voting for a replacement because they'll see a number of people won't be able to afford it. They won't be able to afford to use the coverage if they even sign up for it in the first place. I mean, you already have senators right now that are blanching at the prospect of Medicaid, you know, getting reduced, the number of enrollments. So I think this would add to that, although I don't know that how many people will actually realize what the effect would be.
Yeah, I would agree.
Yeah.
And we will take our next question from Chris Mamula with the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Please go ahead.
Hi. Thank you much. Great forum. Very knowledgeable speakers. I'd like to shift the conversation just a little bit to Medicaid cuts and ask, this might be best for Tim Jost, look into your crystal ball or read the tea leaves and try to, say, predict what form Medicaid cuts are going to take. It's obvious that some kind of cost reduction is in store, and I'm wondering if it's going to be, if you see that in a form of caps for the states, and some of the impact of that, what the impact of that will mean. Locally, there's been fears that it's going to result in basically rationing funds, and that would probably play out in elsewhere, too, if you get a flat rate for the state. The administrators, state administrators, are going to have to decide whether we fund, children with autism or maybe people in nursing homes. I'm not sure, but they're going to have to be making those kinds of decisions. So whatever light you can shed on that would be much appreciated.
Well, I mean, the two proposals that are now on the table with respect to the American Health Care Act as amended are block grants or per capita caps. And I don't actually pretend to be an expert on Medicaid, so I don't know, which of those would be the most likely alternative at this point, or perhaps both of them as a state option. I think the CBO report shows that it would have a pretty dramatic effect on reducing the state money available to the state for Medicaid. And as you point out, I think that would then require states to make some difficult decisions as to what they were going to spend themselves on Medicaid as compared to other things or within categories of Medicaid recipients. One thing just to note is that there's some pretty good evidence that states that, and I think this may have been mentioned earlier, that states that have expanded Medicaid are showing lower premium increases in the private market, and also for states that have not expanded Medicaid, the loss of the cost-sharing reductions would have a much more dramatic effect on premiums because those states would then have to take care of the people who are now being covered by cost-sharing reductions that would be covered by Medicaid in other states, people between 100 and 138% of poverty. So these things are all kind of tied together, and it is something that needs to be kept in mind when we talk about cutting back on Medicaid as to what happens to these people that may now be on receiving premium tax credit assistance.
Thank you.
This is Sarah. I just want to add to that on Tim's last point. In terms of Florida, which is a state that has not expanded Medicaid, it is 72% of the marketplace enrollment is currently receiving cost-sharing reductions. So it's almost 1.3 million people. So you can really see the effect on the loss of cost-sharing reductions in states that don't have Medicaid, and particularly in Florida.
Good. Thank you.
And as a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star and one on your touch-tone phone. And we will take our next question from Donna Rosada with the Consumer Report. Please go ahead.
Hi, sorry, one more question. Could the CSRs be not funded just mid-year? Could they just be cut this year?
Well, if they cut off funding right now, that would be effectively what would happen, that they have now, they have made payments for the first 4 months of the year to the plans. So I suppose that the Trump administration could decide to stop paying as of the May payment. And a couple of problems then. One is that some plans may have the option of ending coverage for 2017. The contract between healthcare.gov, the federal marketplace, and the insurers in the states where that have healthcare.gov says that if this cost-sharing reduction cease, the plans can leave the marketplace. They could not cancel their contracts with their insureds, but the insureds would no longer be able to get premium tax credits, and most could probably not be able to afford it. Now, that's subject to state and federal law, and state law differs from state to state, so that could be a real mess. But if the payment ceased as of this month or next month, I think you would have questions as to whether plans would continue for 2017, and then you would have a huge question as to whether they come back for 2018 and what the premiums would look like. So I think that's a very, very dangerous alternative.
Thank you.
And our next question comes from Guy Bolton with the Milwaukee Journal. Please go ahead.
Yes, thank you. On the projections of people moving into the bronze plan, am I missing something here? But wouldn't people not have money for the deductibles in a bronze plan, even if the premiums did come down to nothing?
This is John. You are correct. Now, California is a little bit special in that we insert into our standard plan benefits a couple of doctor visits there. So even though there is a big deductible, as you're referring to, we also have a couple of doctor visits. What we found, though, is that the low-income population who view themselves as healthy are extremely responsive to low premium prices. It's their first, second, and third thing that they look at. So, you know, like I said, we had the behavioral economists look at it, and from research on this and earlier studies of our plan enrollment, he shows that some people would, in fact, move out of silver into bronze.
Okay. You'd have, of course, an increase in bad debt expense for hospitals and physicians. In states that don't have a couple of doctor visits allowed in a standard plan, you would get these plans might have less appeal, though. Would that be correct, or is that too much of an assumption?
No, I think your comments are all entirely correct. The only thing I'll add to that is along with the other risk we measure, we know the risk between the different tiers. And our people enrolled in bronze today, without any of this going on, are substantially healthier than folks in silver or gold.
And that, of course, would change. And stop me if I'm wrong here, but the real impact, one of the real impacts of this will be for folks who are buying plans off the marketplace or exchange. And the stuff I've seen, that's about half the market, about 10 million people. Would that be correct?
I've seen a number that's a little under 10 million. In California, it's about 1.3 or so with us, and maybe 800,000 or 900,000 that are off exchange. So you're in the right ballpark.
Thank you.
One point you made is, I think, an important one, and that is that if non-funding of the cost-sharing reductions ends up with more people losing coverage or more people having higher cost-sharing, it is healthcare providers who are going to end up holding the bag for a lot of that, because a lot of it's going to result in uncompensated care. And the healthcare hospital, medical associations, even, as I said, the Chamber of Commerce, the Benefits Council, there's just been unanimous expression of concern to Congress about not getting these things taken care of.
Any feel at all for how this could affect the WISP pool? would it just increase the likelihood that healthy people would be less likely to buy coverage?
This is John. Yes, there will be some of that in the rest of our study, which is available in our Covered California website. There, with only looking at the CSR funding, not with any of the other things being talked about, there is a very modest reduction in people in Covered California and, a slightly bigger reduction in people off exchange. So the risk pool is likely to get a little worse, but the numbers I'm talking about, at least from our projection on this single factor, are in the 1-1.5% range. So it's pretty small.
Thank you.
And we will take our next question, a follow-up from Robert Pear with the New York Times. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Is it possible that people who buy health insurance online at healthcare.gov and receive or qualify for cost-sharing reductions do not realize it and are not explicitly informed that they are getting anything special?
This is Sarah. I think that the health, and Tim can weigh in too on this, but healthcare.gov has made it increasingly easier for people to understand what they're selecting when they're selecting health plans. But the at least last year the print was relatively small, and your deductible size is automatically calculated based on your income. So it is possible that people may not connect the term cost-sharing reduction to the lower deductibles that they have in their plans.
They don't even see the full deductible, right, if they put in their income correctly, the lower
right.
income.
That's right.
Yeah. Having shopped for health insurance on healthcare.gov for my son, I don't remember seeing anything about cost-sharing reductions. It was just you plug in an income level, and it gives you the range of deductibles that are available, which is based on your cost-sharing reduction. So I think it's very possible that many, many Americans don't understand what's going on here or know about it.
And I will say, too, just in terms of people not enrolling in the plans that they're eligible for, about 60% of people in the federal marketplaces this year had incomes that made them eligible for the cost-sharing reductions. About 75% of people, 75% of people had incomes in the range that made them eligible. About 60% of the enrollment was in the cost-reduced plans.
And we will take our final question from Karen Pallarito with Health Day. Please go ahead.
Thank you. One quick follow-up. This may be an impossible question to answer, but I have to ask it. So if there is a loss of cost-sharing reductions for 2018, and presuming that, you know, some number of insurers do come back and build that into their rates, what's the range of premium increases that consumers would be facing for 2018?
Okay, so this is John. I will only give you a couple of what I'll call standard factors for 2018, and that could be the average for the country. First
okay.
is you start with what's the standard trend increase, that is the cost of utilization and unit prices. That's about 7% for 2018. To that, you've got to add 2% because there's been a holiday on the roughly 2% health insurance tax, so you're at 9%. And then I'll use the number that's the midpoint or the average from Kaiser Family Foundation of 19%. So the total increase there without funding for the cost-sharing reductions would likely be around 28%, so, you know, say 25 to 30% to give it a range.
Okay. So that would be sort of a nationwide ballpark?
That's right. I picked that number so you could – and, you know, use it in any state. Your mileage may vary.
Yes, and that doesn't reflect anything that might be passed as part of a legislative repeal and replace bill, right?
Yes, you may have recall I was very specific in trying to say this one factor. So other things are in play, and those, of course, add other elements of uncertainty.
Yes. Okay, great. Thank you.
And that does conclude our question and answer session for today.
And this is Sarah Collins. Thank you for listening. If you need additional information, we will be happy to try and provide that. Thank you.